Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast which gives new life to old books. Today, you find us on a road leading out of the coastal town in Essex County in the northeast of Massachusetts. It's August 1885. The heat hangs heavy over everything as we watch a young, elegantly dressed man sitting at an easel. He is sketching out what he sees. In the foreground, a row of willows and rich green pasture broken by grey rocks and a single slender silver birch. Behind, there flows a tidal river and the long, flat vista of the salt marshes stretching out to the horizon. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, where people crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And today we are joined by a new guest, Noreen Masood. Hello, Noreen.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Where are you calling from today, please?
I'm calling from my basement office in the University of Bristol.
Ah, basement.
Yes. Yeah, they really look after us here.
Noreen is a lecturer in English literature at the University of Bristol and an AHRC/BBC New Generation thinker. Her academic monograph, Stevie Smith and the Aphorism, Hard Language, Oxford University Press 2022, won the MSA First Book Award 2023 and the University English Prize 2024. Her memoir, Travelogue, A Flat Place, Hamish Hamilton, Penguin, and Melville House Press in the States, was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction 2024 and the Sunday Times Charlotte Aitken Trust Young Writer of the Year Award, and longlisted for the Jalak Prize and the RSL Ondaatje Prize. Noreen, with those prize listings, it's almost inevitable that A Flat Place is going to become a huge bestseller. You must be getting ready for that to happen.
They're queuing up to read about flat landscapes. What could be better and more gripping?
Exactly. So, you're number one in Smith's travel bookshops and stations, and the publisher comes to you and they say, we need another book from you fast, otherwise you're going to lose your place against Colleen Hoover in the bestseller list. Have you got a book about Stevie Smith you could knock out quickly? And you say, well, I have written a book about Stevie Smith, but it's not really trade friendly. And they say, doesn't matter. Can you rewrite the first one? This is a long-winded way of asking you the question. Not would you do it? Obviously you would.
Yeah.
You want to
keep
Smith
in money,
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Smith in Smiths, exactly. So if you had to rewrite your academic book for a trade audience, what do you think you'd do differently?
Brilliant question. I don't think I'd change much about the style. Yeah, this is a point where I become either, depending on your point of view, usefully or bewilderingly indifferent to what other people think. And the only thing that's interesting to me is that it's beautiful to read. Everything has to be beautiful to read. So I wouldn't change much about the style, because I think the style of both books are kind of, you know, they please me. They're playful, they're energetic. I'd cut out a lot of stuff. Academic books have to do these kinds of performances of allegiances and traditions. They have to kind of explain why they've done certain things and not others. And that's just kind of boring. So that would all go. And I'd probably turn the footnotes into endnotes.
You've thought this through. Look how ready you are.
Oh, yeah. I've thought about this.
Hamish Hamilton. Yeah. Hamish Hamilton will be listening again.
Simon Prosser, I hope you're on the case.
Okay, so I have got a question which I'm always interested by. So you're saying, I recognise entirely what you're saying about the need to provide academic context to the ideas you're presenting within an academic framework, right? Is there an extent to which you feel obliged or obliged to resist, one way or the other, jargon as a way of academic jargon as a way of reassuring potential readers at the expense of the beauty of the writing? Or do you just try and hold that at arm's length?
So are you thinking about my academic work or my trade writing here?
No, if an academic's work, not your academic work per se, but the need to use particular kinds of words which indicate contemporary thought or approaches to the study of literature, which you wouldn't use in a trade writing.
Oh, interesting.
Would you?
So I should start by saying I think that specialist language is... And language which provides a shorthand in which one word will do instead of a whole paragraph when you're speaking to other specialists.
Yeah.
That serves a really important purpose in English studies, just as it does in physics and maths. So I'm, you know, in a weird sense, I'm pro-jargon, where it's doing the job of communicating to other specialists. Having said that, I would struggle to enjoy writing a sentence which relied heavily, or I would feel very self-conscious about writing in a way that turned totally on one jargon word. And what I tend to do in that case is to play around it, you know, to sort of weigh it up and throw it and maybe add, hopefully add a little, well, on my terms, a little bit of lightness or fun around it. But I don't think I use jargon that much. I'm sure people are reading my work now and screaming in protest.
No, I'm sure you don't. My challenge to you is to work the phrase hermeneutic possibilities into our chat at some point today.
I feel like I can't, because hermeneutic is one of those words whose meaning I only hold very precariously in my head. I've taught hermeneutics, I teach literary theory, and yet there's a little part of me always that isn't quite sure whether I've got it right. So that won't be happening, but thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for pushing back. Thank God for that.
I think you're absolutely right about that sense of somehow theory is always just slightly ahead of what you understand,
which is, I think,
why so much of it is so difficult to understand.
So difficult, and also so joyful as well, right? At its best, good literary theory is absolutely the same as reading poetry. You know, I read Derrida and I'm in the presence of something that isn't just the conveying of content. It's poetry in the sense that it's always punning. It's more than just what it might, quote unquote, mean or translate into as a tool. So, yeah, long excursion into Derrida.
It's great. Well, I think, you know, we're not in Kansas now, Toto, for the next hour in terms of theory, because we should say that the book, Noreen, that you've chosen to discuss for us is The Marsh Island by Sylvia Orne Jewett, first serialised in January 1885 in the Atlantic Monthly magazine and published in full later that year by Houghton Mifflin. Working in the tradition of American regionalism, A Marsh Island centres on Richard Dick Dale, who is a young, urban, privileged, well-travelled and keen to develop his skills as an artist. One August afternoon, he finds himself painting in the middle of the Great Salt Marsh, New England, northeastern Massachusetts. As evening falls, he realizes he's been stranded and is offered shelter by the Owens family, whose farm is centered on a small, idyllic hill, the Marsh Island of the book's title. Charmed by their old-fashioned honesty and integrity, and by the simple beauty of their daughter Doris, Dick decides to stay on and make an artistic study of the farm and its dramatic vistas that surround it. His feelings for all the family, and in particular Doris, deepen as the book progresses and inevitably create tension with other members of the community, in particular Dan Lester, who has always assumed that Doris would become his wife.
The book was Sarah Orne Jewett's personal favourite among her seven novels, although she's probably still best known for her 1896 novel The Country of the Pointed Firs. A Marsh Island is set, like almost all her novels and stories, in the coastal region of New England, and it investigates the landscapes and the small communities that populate that landscape with a detached eye for detail and nuance. In particular, the novel explores the tensions between rural and urban ways of life in late 19th century East Coast America, and the book was written at a moment in Jewett's own life when she had just begun an unconventional relationship with another woman. And we will discuss how that plays out in the subversive presentation of relationships in the novel. So please join us to find out more about A Marsh Island by Sylvia Orne Jewett after this short break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back, champing at the bit to discuss A Marsh Island. We also want to say Yes. We are backlisted. We're very excited. We've got a residency coming up in the West End of London. So if you live in London or the South East and you want to come and see once a month a show being recorded, you will have that opportunity to do so. The first of them is taking place on the top floor at Foyle's in Charing Cross Road. We will be discussing Forbes Maddox Ford's novel, The Good Soldier, with our guest, Alex Michaelides, and perhaps someone else. We're waiting to confirm. And you can find a link to tickets, to purchase tickets, in the show notes for this episode. The date for your diary is Wednesday, the 15th of May, 2024. We start at 6:30 p.m. and we will actually be recording two shows on that night. First of all, an episode of Locklisted to go out on our Patreon. And then secondly, the discussion of Forbes Maddox Ford's The Good Soldier. And that's the first of a regular residency. We will be recording one show a month. So we'd love, love, love it if some of our loyal listeners feel like coming along and joining us for that particular show and the shows that follow. Noreen, before I ask you where you first read this novel, is it quite unusual for you to spend time chatting about it with two other people who've read it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've never spoken in person to anyone else who's read it. So, hi.
Is that true? Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah.
Because John and I were saying, we've both really enjoyed reading this book. And I have to say, for me, one of the reasons is I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
I could find very little about it to back me up. And so, actually, it was bracing to be thrown into a novel with comparatively little, comparatively few secondary sources to draw
brain.
John's and that of yours. So I'm genuinely looking forward to this discussion.
Oh, I'm thrilled.
To find out more about the book itself, apart from anything else.
I don't know how much I have to offer on that front, but let's find out.
I doubt that. Now, okay, when did you first encounter this book or come across Sarah Orne Jewett?
So I've known about Orne Jewett for a couple of years. Because as well as writing my trade book, my memoir travelogue on flat landscapes, I'm also working on an academic monograph on flat landscapes in 20th century literature. And one of my main authors that I look at is Willa Cather, you know, who's better known for her sort of Prairies trilogy, My Antonia, O Pioneers, and The Song of the Lark. And Cather was mentored by Orne Jewett. Orne Jewett writes a really famous letter to Catherine in 1908, telling her how the key to her writing is going to be to focus on Orne Jewett calls her own quiet centre of life. And I think it's, you know, Cather would later call The Country of the Pointed Firs one of the three books by American authors that was going to last, basically. Like, she was an incredibly influential writer for the young Cather.
Mm.
And you can see how after that, the kind of flat landscapes, the prairies around Cather become her main focus, those flat landscapes. And so I looked at Orne Jewett's own work and was very struck by a book that was also about flat landscapes. And it opens on that flat salt marsh. One of the things I'm really interested in the monograph is the relationship between a flat landscape and queerness. What does it mean to be in a landscape that has no landmarks, nothing to orientate towards or away from? How do you locate yourself? How do you locate other people? How do you create attractions? What does desire look like in a landscape where there is nothing to look at or move towards? And obviously, Orne Jewett's relationship with Annie Fields, as well as the really fascinating queernesses in this novel. Yeah, I got really interested.
Would I be right in thinking, for instance, speaking of the relationship between queerness and flat landscapes, that in the UK, Dungeness offers us an example of that very thing.
Massively.
In terms of Jarman's occupation of that space and how he indeed and his garden have become synonymous with Dungeness. Are there other areas of the UK that fulfil that description?
I think that all flat landscapes, you know, even the kind of archetype of a flat landscape where there's no landmark, is performing or sort of challenges us to confront a kind of queerness. if sexual orientation is to be orientated towards someone, that's how Sara Ahmed talks about it, to be orientated towards something or something, think of it as something spatial, then in a flat landscape, there is nothing to orientate towards. And it becomes a question of what one doesn't orientate towards as much as what one does. A sense of refusal, a sense of veering away from or having nothing to locate yourself in relation to.
Right, yeah.
But having said that, I think that most flat landscapes there are in the UK are very watery flat landscapes. It's not like we've not got, you know, the salt flats of Brazil here. A flat landscape that's related to water is one that's constantly changing. You know, I think of Morecambe Bay. The water's always coming out and receding. The safe paths through are always changing. It's a very unstable landscape, a very unpredictable landscape.
And there's a hint of menace,
massively,
isn't there, as well?
Yeah.
Obviously, thinking about the terrible Cocklepicker Morecambe Bay story, but it's like the hulks in Great Expectations. You know, there's always this, although you can see for miles, there's always the possibility that there's a magwitch going to leap out of the marsh and grab you by the throat. It's really interesting.
Flat landscapes are so threatening. You know, I think of Beckett, and so much of Beckett happens on just these bare landscapes. Yeah. So much of these sort of like post-apocalyptic bare experiences. What's rarer is experiences of flat landscapes as good or interesting or potentially enriching. And I focus in my book, in my academic monograph, on flat landscapes that do more than just upset and distress.
Yes. You've made me think about A Warning to the Curious by M.R. James, very specifically the television adaptation with there's the repeated shot of the man being pursued across a very flat landscape.
Yeah. Pursuit's big in flat landscapes.
Pursuit. And also I discovered a very pleasing academic term that I hadn't encountered before in relation to this novel specifically, and that was metronormative.
Yes.
Hilarious. I don't even know what that means.
Do you know what that
you,
is?
It's like, you, Andy.
Is it to do with the city? I've got two options, right? Tell me which
go
is
on,
right.
Here we go.
So either metronormative is about the city as shaping our sense of what is normal and what is good, how society should shape itself, or it's to do with metrosexual normativity. I'm hoping it's one of those two. Is it neither?
Well, okay. In the context in which I encountered it, it was discussing the character of Dick in this novel as arguably retreating at the end of the novel into a metronormative existence with, what's he called?
Bradfield? Is that?
Yes, Bradfield.
In other words,
it's more difficult to be...
Bradish.
It's easier to be queer in... metropolitan settings, which have a network.
So it is the city,
places, cafes, etc., 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 right? So it's an alternative to heteronormative, it's metronormative.
Perfect.
And exactly as you say, one of the wonderful things about this book is the presentation of landscape as a place of unmooring, a place in which identity starts to dissolve.
Yes.
I wonder, would you be kind enough then to read us the opening of the novel?
For sure. And this is a bit where flat landscapes get really weird and raises a question of why or how we look at flat landscapes. One August afternoon, the people who drove along the East Road of a pleasant Sussex county town were much interested in the appearance of a young man who was hard at work before a slender easel near the wayside. Most of the spectators felt a strong desire to linger. If any had happened to be afoot, they would surely have looked over the artist's shoulder. As it was, they inspected with some contempt the bit of scenery which was honoured with so much attention. This was in no way remarkable. They saw a familiar row of willows and a foreground of pasture, broken here and there by grey rocks, while beyond a tide river the marshes seemed to stretch away to the end of the world. Almost everyone who drove along would have confidently directed the stranger to a better specimen of the natural beauties of the town, yet he seemed unsuspicious of his mistake and painted busily. Sometimes he strolled away, apparently taking aimless steps, but always keeping his eyes fixed upon the landscape, while once he flung himself impatiently at full length on the soft grass in the shade of the nearest tree. One would have said that such enthusiastic interest in his pursuit was exceptional rather than common with him, but he presently took a new view of his subject from this point, and after some reflection rose and went nearer to a slender birch tree which stood in his left foreground. There was a touch of uncommon colour on one of its leaves, which had been changed early, and he held the twig in his hand, rustled it, and looked up at the topmost branches, which seemed all a-shiver at the strange attention. The light breeze passed over. The young tree was still again. A boy might have bent it and cut and trimmed it with his jackknife for an afternoon's fishing, and the artist reached out and for a moment held the stem, which had lately put on its first white dress. Then he let it spring away from him. Trees that grow alone have a great deal more individuality than those which stand in companies. The young man gave another look at the charming outline of this one and went back toward his easel. As he turned, he was suddenly attracted by the beauty of the landscape which had been behind him all the afternoon. The moor-like hills were beginning to grow purple, and a lovely light had gathered into the country which lay between him and the western sky. He condemned himself for having been so easily suited with his point of view, and felt dissatisfied and displeased for the moment with his day's work. At his feet grew an enticing crop of mushrooms, and with a sigh at the evasiveness of art, he stooped to gather the little harvest and filled a handkerchief with the delicate pink and white fungi, tossing away the sunburnt ones of yesterday's growth and biting two or three of the smallest buttons with a good relish. "If I only had some salt now," he said to himself. "I wonder what time it is." Then he looked somewhat eagerly along the road, as if he expected a companion. Nobody could be discovered. It was some time since any traveller had passed that way. The few wagons that had gone to market early in the morning had long since returned, and the greater part of the men and horses were busy on the marshes, for this was the time of year for cutting the salt hay. When he looked at his sketch again, it made him forget his other thoughts, and holding his brush at arm's length, and again stepping to and fro lightly, he put in some necessary touches with most delicate intention and pleasure. "Not so bad," he said half aloud, "though my birch tree does not look as if she could flit away if I frightened her, as the real one does."
That's so good.
That's really wonderful. Thank you.
Not at all.
I think one of the things I find so interesting about this novel is how, and this isn't an academic observation, is how straightforwardly good that prose
yeah.
is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
As the pleasure of listening to you read that was how balanced and rhythmical and well judged that is, just as a series of sentences.
Completely. And it's very rare that you read something where the only awkwardnesses that fall are the ones that are doing a job, you know?
Yes, right. I cut you off when you were talking earlier about how you first encountered this book. Let me ask you a slightly different question then. How soon into the reading of A Marsh Island did your ears prick up, as it were, and you think, oh, this is something different. This is really fascinating.
That first passage.
Yes, I wonder whether that was the case. Yeah, okay.
To me, that image of somebody absorbedly painting a landscape in which there is nothing to look at, quote unquote, or in which we are told there is nothing to look at. Immediately, you know that you're in the presence of someone with a rare mind, right?
I'm going to agree. Yes.
that's pretty thin gruel for the start of a novel, most people would think, right? Here's somebody painting something that's not very interesting.
It's like a catnip to me. Just the idea that to see as worthwhile something that other people would not is the first thing that I thought was so interesting. And to kind of call into question how we value things and what we value, I mean, is the one big thing. And then the second thing, what I love about this is how much he changes his mind in that passage. He has a moment of seeing it as others might see it and feeling dispirited. And then he gets a little bit distracted. And then he comes back to it and says, actually, it's all right, really. And that to me is something so unusual in a novel. The only person who really does anything similar, I think, is D.H. Lawrence. Lawrence is so good at tracing a mind through all its little changes, all its little ficklenesses, and not suggesting that the final point of view cancels out what's come before. You know, he's interested in the mind as it changes and respecting it in each alteration. And Jewett's also very good at that.
I'm going to defer to my colleague, John Mitchinson, who is far more of a Lawrence aficionado than I am. What do you,
I think that's right. I think there is always a feeling that you're being beaten up a bit by Lawrence, you know. He's always kind of grabbing you and pushing your nose into stuff and saying, oh, this is what I'm, what about this? Whereas this is so delicate and almost the way she builds up, I think the not much, let's be honest, happens in this book. And that's one of the reasons that Andy and I both love it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not distorted by plot, that's for
sure. There's so much to say about that plot, isn't there? And that bizarre little attempt in inverted commas at a climax that turns out to have been completely
pointless.
Unnecessary.
Yeah, we must. Don't worry, everybody. Spoilers here are really not anything you need to worry about. So what I noticed in, there's an excellent web resource for Sarah Orne Jewett, which we will ensure
on the page,
is linked to on our website. But what I noticed about most of the contemporary reviews of A Marsh Island is several of them refer to it as a watercolor or a painting that her, you know, without a pun intended, on the marshy surroundings, that it's the qualities of scenery and scene setting that when Jewett was writing were the things that she was best known for. And I have a review here from the Overland Monthly, June 1885. And Noreen, I will ask you to comment on this, you know. Go on, stick it to this 140-year-old reviewer. Miss Jewett's new story has the grace of restraint, perfect simplicity and directness, and the best of breeding in matter and manner. But this comment, and most other such that could be made, are merely repeating what everyone knows already of Miss Jewett's invariable traits as a writer. Her style may be called well-nigh perfect. This particular story is perhaps less delightful than A Country Doctor, yet that is more because the subject is less notably happy than anything else. There is not much story, but one does not want much story in Miss Jewett's books. They are transcripts of bits of life, not regularly constructed novels with plot and machinery. The very fields and sea and farming folk are in them. They do not pretend to go as deeply into human nature, nor to be as minutely or vividly true to it as some novels, but in its own way, the characterization is perfect. They are like a painter's outdoor studies. Wonderfully uniform they are, too, in this latest one. Neither falling away from the mark of previous achievement nor improving upon it is visible. In work so perfect in its own way, perhaps nothing of the sort is to be expected. The idly is Miss Jewett's line, and tragedies and dramas and the like are not to be sought among her quiet and fragrant fields.
Do you know what I think is so funny in a kind of bitter, resigned way about that? Is that this reviewer, you know, bless them, has completely, I don't know, I wouldn't have recognised the novel they're describing from that description, you know, because how can you think it's superficial in terms of characterization? But the irony is, and it's fitting, I suppose, but this is a novel precisely about our total inability to read one another. The way that we're never seeing each other, we're never speaking to each other, we're never hearing each other, we're only ever addressing versions of our own fantasies and our own projections. And of course, this is what's happening in that review, as happens in so many reviews of work by women. Small things happen and people are stupid enough to mistake that for nothing happening.
That's how well put.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. A recurring theme of this podcast is very much been along those lines, in fact. John, you said that there was some surprise expressed by members of our Patreon community that we were going to be talking about A Marsh Island rather than another title by Sarah Orne Jewett. In what tradition is Sarah Orne Jewett writing?
It gets called American regionalism, which is is such a broad... I mean, were you to be the kind of lazy Wikipedia-type researcher that I clearly am, you would find... You would find, obviously, Willa Cather, who we've talked about.
Go on.
I think more interestingly, and I think there is a real connection with Kate Chopin's The Awakening, which we covered last year.
And indeed we covered, didn't we? We covered...
We did My Antonia by Willa Cather with the great Hermione Lee. It's, I mean, I would say it's novels about particularly strong in American regions. You know, you find Richard Ford on the list of regional writers, as well as, you know, Eudora Welty and Mark Twain and John Kennedy Toole. It becomes so broad as to be meaningless. Shall I give you the definitions? A focus on the setting of the story, often to such a degree that it appears little else happens beyond description of the setting and people. Characters that are somewhat stereotypical, offering a picture of actual perceived common traits from that region. A great deal of nostalgia and resistance to change. Use of local dialect, especially in the dialogue. Thick descriptions of people, places, and things that the author means to highlight. Well, yes, you could say, or, you know, guilty as charged with this book. But yes, you could imagine there's a lot of writers who do that. It's like people who write local histories. She is so precise that every single plant and bird in this novel has been observed by somebody who really has watched it. And not only does she observe the details, I think she is somehow able to make you feel the psychological. That's maybe where, Noreen, that kind of Lawrence feeling, there's not a bird or a plant or any bit of landscape in this book that doesn't seem heavily freighted with significance for the characters. And that's what that's what I love about it, I have to say. I just feel it's such a rich... dense. I mean, couldn't be further away from that reviewer's description of it. And if that makes it American regionalism, fine. But it's a lot better than, you know, to be honest, it's a lot more readable than Harriet Beecher Stowe.
I totally agree with you. And I wouldn't recognise the novel from that review. But equally, neither would I recognise it from as an example of regionalism.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Not necessarily because of my ignorance of the genre, but more because that's not what I took away from my reading of the novel.
What did you take away?
I feel the novel is about Dick, the artist defined or not defined by his or her environment.
Mm.
Now that I'm bringing my own preoccupations, obviously, to
that's what fiction's for, after all.
Exactly, right? But to me, so most of these reviews don't really talk about him, and actually most of the reviews don't actually talk about the characters. They tend very much to talk about landscape or, as you say, the smallness of the observation. And those observations are particular, but they're not insignificant. And to pick up something you said earlier, things that almost happen but then don't, or things that you think might happen on a bigger canvas, on an oil painting, the great swathe of drama, they don't happen. And of course, that's what's good about it. That's what's so interesting about it. The space that is left not just for the character to wander around in, but for us as readers to wander around in.
And as somebody whose main focus is on landscape, you know, I have to say, I read this book because I read so many books. I was like, give me more landscape, you know, and get these characters off, get out of the way. I need to look at the landscape. So for me, I definitely didn't think there weren't enough characters. But it's, I mean, when you were talking, Andy, I was thinking about, absolutely, this is a novel about Dale, right? And then I thought, well, could we say it's a novel about Doris? Could we say it's a novel about Mrs. Owens? And actually, the only character who isn't necessarily massively fleshed out is Mr. Owens. You know, even to an extent, it's a novel about Bradish, you know, who sort of, he weirdly haunts the novel throughout.
Yes, that's really true. That's really true and fascinating. And you've used the word haunts as well, which I want to come back to, which is very important. But this idea, this constant siren call by Dale's chum back in New York, who's mentioned repeatedly, you know, is that encoding something into the novel that contemporary readers would have recognised? Or is it, do you think it's our latter sensibility that's being brought to bear?
Great question. And I obviously there's a deliberate ambiguity, but I think that bit where Dan Lester thinks about the kind of down-to-earth, you know, good at farming Dan Lester, thinks about Dale as a bit of a Miss Nancy.
I think that uses that exact term.
That's a term that people would have recognised, and people would have recognised the implications of that.
I just say I'm not 100%. I think one of the joys of this book is actually that I think the father is really quite a good character. I mean, quite a complex character. And there's an extraordinary bit that Israel, Owens, and Doris get to ride together. I mean, emotionally, she's already decided that, spoiler alert, that she feels she needs to commit herself to Dan, the local boy who's loved her since, and that the complex feelings that Dick has elicited in her from, you know, being sophisticated and good looking and urbane and artistic, she's decided she can't really bridge that gap. And there's a marvelous bit where her father understands that. There's a bit of an uncomfortableness between them. And I just think Jewett really captures that very, very complicated relationship between a father who has lost his son, because Andy, I think you're probably, when you mention haunting, the book is haunted by the memory. Or the Owens family are haunted by the memory of Israel Jr., who died age 20 in the Civil War. And that there's an amazing bit where the father, she says her father said he's going to go out and cut hedges, and she finds him hours later up in the hills just sitting with his head in his hands. You know, the idea of grief, unprocessed grief, which this book is about as well, and which in some strange way Dick becomes the kind of the character that enables the family to come to terms with their grief. But I think there is no, I mean, maybe Temperance, the slightly sceptical maid, is a stock character, but I'm amazed for a book of this period where you really don't have any kind of wasted material, any characters that are just thrown. Like you say, Bradish is actually, like you say, Andy, haunts the book in the way that Israel Jr. haunts the book.
If we're talking about figures in a landscape, is this novel about community, or is it about individuals trying to find one another in a landscape?
Oh, wow. I might be really provocative and say that I don't think it's about either. I think this is a novel about money and class.
Ooh.
Yeah. So one of the, I mean, the thing, Dick turns up, immediately he launches into fantasy. This is the thing, talking about it as a regional novel, it seems to me that this novel is like mocking or satirizing, you know, the sort of quaint regionalism, you know, because Dale turns up, the painter, and he's like, ooh, isn't this beautiful? Isn't this quaint? Oh, and he starts interfering with Mrs. Owen's own decorations and saying, oh, you should keep this, you should get rid of that. He's designing their farmhouse in accordance with his own regionalist fantasies and his painterly fantasies of what a homely farmhouse should look like. He's always arranging things. And the reason he can fantasize about Doris, or maybe kind of get, you know, marrying Doris and these tiny little, the momentary desire to kiss Doris, which is gone as soon as it came. All of these are games that you can only play if you've got money. And it's really explicit about the fact that Dick has not achieved what he should have achieved. He's been lazier than he should have done. He's always thought of as having this infinite potential that he never actually needs to fulfill because he's got money. And he's got more money than Bradish. Bradish is always like driven to be productive and useful and to paint and to succeed because he has to or he can't live. But Dale is a man of independent means, which means that he can enter people's lives and enter into a fantasy and then leave again. That's, again, I'm thinking of, and this is sounding very mean to Dick. I don't mean to be mean to Dick, but it reminds me of The Great Gatsby. And to be the way that if you have money, you can be careless. You can come and smash things up a little bit and then go away and everything's fine and you're not affected. And this novel steers away from that. But there's a little bit of Dick getting to come and play around and cause trouble and then leave.
Is Jewett drawing a parallel between herself and that character in terms of the artist fetishizing not just the landscape, but the types of individual within it.
Yeah.
Right? So Dick is always seeing the mother and the father, and to some extent Doris, as charming types produced in this kind of regional area, which seems to me like a fairly self-aware comment on regionalism as a trait in literature.
Totally.
Right? She's saying, I am looking at these individuals. I am looking at my characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got the strong feeling I was reading someone writing with a consciousness much ahead of their time.
Oh, yeah.
If you told me this was written in the 1930s, I think I would have believed you.
Yeah,
do you think?
Definitely. Yeah, that's really interesting. Is it important that Dale is an outsider coming in and then he goes away? As Orne Jewett is always, you know, in her letter to Katha, saying, write from where you are, write about what is around you. Don't enter in, don't sort of feel that you have to go into other spheres. Write from your starting point. Yeah, but I definitely think there's a real anxiety about art and about depiction and what it does, what it distorts.
Well, when we come back after this break, we're going to hear another little section of the novel, which is devoted to how the artist sees the landscape after he's been there for a while, which I found totally fascinating. So join us after the jump and
back in the room.
We'll pick up there.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Here we are again. I've just got a little part here I would like to read you, just a paragraph, I think. This is near the beginning of chapter 9. So Dick Dale has been in staying with the family because he's hurt his ankle, and he's out in the fields and he's painting and he's spending time with people. But he's also undertaken to make a drawing of the younger Israel Owen, their lost child. And there's the beginning of a sense that Jewett gives you that the longer Dale spends time in this environment, the more he begins to dissolve into the spirit, and I use the word advisedly, the spirit of the late soldier and the landscape itself. So this is what I mean. Here's just this one paragraph. In these days, nobody stopped to think much about Dick Dale's lingering at the farmhouse. His temporary invalidism was the cause of most friendly relations with all the family. His presence appeared completely natural and inevitable. When he had given Israel Owen an excellent drawing made from the small picture of the soldier, there was no longer any question of the artist's being welcome to anything upon the island. Dick had taken great pains with this experiment in portrait making. He told himself that he was not ashamed of it either, though he was most grateful for having had some aid to contentment during the few days he had kept his lame foot still in the clock room. He was not without his fancies about the portrait's subject, for as he worked, he had a vague consciousness of an unseen presence. And some most telling touches were almost made in spite of himself.
It really is.
He thought often of the possible unseen dwellers in such old houses. And as he resumed his out-of-door rambles, it was with a continued sense of companionship, or as if another was sharing the use of his own eyes.
Mm.
That's very eerie.
So
in its
eerie.
Own quiet way.
So eerie.
What is happening there? Why does Jewett need to evoke that sense of haunting, which she does throughout the book?
What I love, one of the many things I, as I think I've said, love about this book is the way that it opens up so many possibilities but has the sense not to pursue them to their conclusions. A lesser writer wouldn't have said that unless they were writing a ghost story. But what Jewett does here is she allows a ghost in and then the ghost goes away. How great. How great. The ghost doesn't become the centre. It could have so easily become a kind of Tenorpenny Gothic sort of fantasia, but it didn't. What I love, so much I love about that passage, both the Owen parents allow Dick Dale to stay and kind of enjoy him, partly because they are so desperate to see in him the features of their son. I think the mother says, oh, you know, he favours him around the eyes and the forehead. Does he? And then all the characters are looking and they're like, yeah, I guess he does. But, you know, again, that's strongly hinted this is just a projection.
That's And the
father thinks that, she thinks that. And there's all this kind of, there's this sort of mass decision to project Israel upon Dale. And then I think it's so interesting that Dale sort of takes that up in turn and then kind of projects onto Israel. I love that word. He talks about the telling touches made almost without his own agency. And I don't know what telling means there. I've been musing on it as you were reading. Because telling might mean accurate or correct, but it might also create the sense of conveying something or betraying something that you maybe subconsciously knew only subconsciously or didn't mean to admit.
Some most telling touches.
Yeah.
Telling of were made almost in spite of himself. Almost in spite of himself.
And I don't know whether they're good.
So is there also a suggestion that it's inspiring him in some way?
Absolutely.
That a more, forgive me, metronormative environment would not.
There's the other thing, we've got to pull this in really, is that this book was written within, I think, a year or two of Jewett moving in with Annie Fields, who was the widow of a friend. And they, between them, established a, what was new discovery to me, something at the time was called a Boston marriage, where two women lived together reasonably respectably and also, you know, exchanged vows and rings, but lived more or less as partners.
I was intrigued by that, though. So this is a bit like the phrase Miss Nancy.
Yeah.
Was the phrase Boston marriage a euphemism, or was it a separate asexual arrangement that was widely recognised?
There's a lot of debate around that.
Yeah.
And I think what's very clear is that a Boston marriage could be so many things to different people. And yeah, absolutely, as John was saying, some exchanged vows and rings and very clearly had a sexual arrangement. For others, you know, I always think of that useful word friend.
Yeah.
It's this lovely capacious word. To say we're friends, it can mean to say there is nothing sexual between us, there's nothing romantic. But equally, of course, friend has this long history in Western writing of me, oh, we are friends. Oh, yeah. You know, sexy friends, right? It both kind of dismisses and contains sex and the possibility of sex and romance. So absolutely many Boston marriages were clearly romantic relationships. Others, I think we have, I admire the work of Sharon Marcus, who says, well, sometimes things were just as they were described. Sometimes friends are just friends. And I think, we have to open the possibility of, as you say, asexual arrangements or other kinds of queerness, other kinds of unaccommodated ways of relating to each other.
There's an early episode of Dad's Army in which Private Godfrey says to Mannering, I thought it'd be rather nice if my friend could come. Yes. And Mannering turns to Wilson and said, he's got a friend.
That's perfect.
So,
but also in this novel, the word companion and companionship, was used in the section you read, Noreen. I know the editor of the edition we've got here, Don James McLaughlin, says companion or companionship is used 20 times in this short novel.
Big word.
As a signal of the one who does or doesn't walk beside me, I suppose, in a sense.
Mm. Don't you think that idea that she, I mean, unlike most of her books, where she's often got women narrators, you feel that what's really interesting her in this book is Dick.
Mm.
And Dick kind of dropped in, almost in deus ex machina way, into this apparently normal, wholesome, rural family that has got way more stuff going on than you immediately, you know, the rural idyll, it's not shattered, but Dick is the sort of the instrument that changes
that.
But unlike, I would say, a kind of a Hardy or a Lawrence, it's so far from melodrama, this book, isn't it?
Apart from and, the climax.
You know, as you say, the climax is kind of some young man telling a story that turns out not to be true and a woman rowing like a maniac in the early mornings.
Having to be rescued, yes.
There's a sense, you know, when you get those bits of Doris saying, you know, she felt as she were on the verge of a greater sea, which might prove either wonderfully wonderful happiness or bitter misery, and confused and dismayed by her loyalty to both her lovers, she hid her face in her hands, that she's trembling on the brink of being a kind of tragic heroine, but in the end she isn't. That was something you alluded to very early on, Noreen, that this book is about as much to do with what doesn't happen as what does, which I think is one of the things that makes it so fascinating.
Everything just turns, all the decisions in this novel, all the incidents such as they are, and all the feelings that the characters have about each other, turn on the tiniest things. That really hit me in this reread. There's one bit where it becomes clear that a lot of the feelings that Dick Dale is having is, at one point, it's because he's hungry, you know? Like, whether we love something or hate it, like, you know, let's not discount the role of hunger in informing these things. Like, and there's another bit where Mrs. Owen is like, oh, yeah, you can see she's thinking, oh, you know, Dick Dale will be a great match for my Doris, you know, because she's always wanted to get into town and have more adventures in her life. And she thinks that Dick might be a way in for that. And then she finds that he's got some writing in Italian among his things. And that, and oh, that sways her. And she's like, oh, actually, no, maybe Dan would be better. Tiny things.
I love that.
Noreen Massoud is a reader in Hanger Normative Studies at the University of Bristol.
But when he goes back home with his aunt, you know, there's a terrible kind of like, it's like the embarrassment of like Joe Gargery arriving in London, only in reverse, when the aunt's suddenly on the farm and she says, you know, do you think I can get butter from them? And he looks at her like, and it was obvious that he never really thought about, but that's not, he's not here for the butter. But then when he goes home with them and he's really, you know, he's having all these thoughts, she just puts in a line, he'd rarely enjoyed his supper more because he's got back home to the comforts of urban life. And
I would like to self-advocate here, as I'm being encouraged to do by my counsellor, and say that it's all very well you two talking about D.H. Lawrence and Thomas Hardy. They are two of my least favourite writers in the world.
I do know that.
I much preferred Sarah Orne Jewett.
Yes.
Leaving something to the imagination rather than attempting to scribble in every corner of the page as those two gents do, right? Do you know what I mean, though? I mean, I don't know if that's a function of style or gender or the relationship of how a female novelist would see themselves in that era, as opposed to how a male novelist, certainly in the case of the important men, Hardy and Lawrence, how they would think of themselves. You're laughing, Noreen. I hate those guys. Let's just.
Andy, say what you really feel. You know, don't hold back.
Say what you really feel.
My counselling is going well.
Can I run a quiz?
Okay.
It's not often I do this, Andy.
Yes, please.
I want Tess, our producer, to run a clip, and I want you to listen to the clip, and then I want either one of you to tell me why on earth we would be playing this clip in this episode.
Reckon you're the first.
No, sir, I don't.
You ain't. Fine on, she were. Clean built and trig looking. None more fleet in 64 than she. We were on the brakes. A mutiny it were. Why ask you why? What's the terrible part of a sailor's life? Ask you, lad. Is when the work stops, when you're twixt wind and water. Doldrums, eviler than the devil. Boredom makes men to villains, and the water goes quick, lad. Vanished. The only medicine is drink. Keeps them sailors happy, keeps them agreeable, keeps them calm, keeps them
stupid.
Right. There you go.
Well, I've immediately lost the quiz. I've got no idea.
Okay, really.
I just wondered why, John, you'd taken a tape recorder down to the pub in the village with you. What?
Well, of course, it is an excerpt from The Lighthouse, and that is Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson playing two remote lighthouse keepers. But do you know why that is of any relevance to this book.
Tell us.
Because, I will tell you, if you don't know, because Robert Eggers, his research for the accents, the dialects and the accents, was entirely based on the work of Sarah Orne Jewett. Because it's basically based in Maine. The Lighthouse is based in Maine. And he read, and even the word trig that he uses appears in the book.
Noreen, do you want to have a stab at that in the next reading? Do you want to give it some broad...
I cannot think of a worse idea.
Yes. Yeah, me neither.
But there you go. Sarah Orne Jewett, a consultant to the A24 hit movie, wow. The Lighthouse.
That is a magnificent... Noreen, I'd just like to go back to this idea, please, about... I was being exaggerating for comic effect on Lawrence and Hardy. But with Sarah Orne Jewett, this idea of things that don't happen or moments of intense drama around a phrase said or unsaid is something I would associate, say, with Henry James rather than with... Yeah. Sarah Orne Jewett. Is this a thing in Victorian literature in general, that the moment of high drama in stillness, is that something we should look out for more?
That's a brilliant question. So I'll give you the disclaimer first. I'm not a Victorianist. I'm sure I can hear my colleagues rising up to protest and disagree with me. I think what I associate it with, certainly, I think the Henry James link is exactly right. It's that kind of turn of the century movement towards what starts to look like early modernism. And again, I'm thinking of that biscuit in Henry James. That's the key moment, isn't it? The biscuit on the floor is it The Wings of the Dove? I can never remember. She sees the biscuit on the floor and it tells everything. It betrays the affair. It betrays what has been. Again, absolutely, that drama in the tiny. Or, conversely, the way that drama may slightly exist off screen or is something that nearly happens but doesn't quite happen. Yeah, I think it's a very late Victorian, early 20th century thing.
It seemed to me fairly radical in this novel that you tease the idea of a narrative of romance and then you leave it in the terms of the time, certainly, as it must have been bafflingly underdeveloped. Yeah. You make every signal that you're bringing these two disparate people together, and then they quietly decide, no, I won't
brilliant.
Do that.
It's so brilliant, and I absolutely think it's radical. And it was, and that's it. What I love about it, it wasn't that Orne Jewett didn't finish it. It's that she goes to great lengths to emphasise the randomness of all of these things and the fact that it nearly happened. And again, the climax is a good example. You know, Doris is running to kind of stop Dan from sailing off and leaving her behind. And then when she arrives, he's already decided not to go because his mother convinced him because he didn't like the look of the rest of the crew. She didn't need to add that bit. She could absolutely have sunk into the traditional patterns of romance where Doris did rescue, save Dan and sort of confess her love at that moment. But she added that bit to specifically steer us away from the romance plot or the romance plot in that follows that simple shape where individual characters have agency, where people know what they want and pursue it, and where what happens, happens because it's right, because it's the right thing for those people. I love this bit in the book where Doris says, if she should ever love anyone, she wished the lover would understand and say little about it to her or to anyone else. That's a bit that always stays with me.
Yes.
The idea that you just want everyone to know everything about you already and you don't want to have the trouble of having to explain yourself or ask for anything. And what that's another way of saying that is it's a desire for the kind of normal machinery of romance to step in and sweep you away,
right.
I think.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
I love that Jewett refuses to let that happen.
We are going to have to wrap up in a minute. John, I've got a quiz for you.
Great.
This novel features one of my favourite things in novels. I've got to give you a clue. I want to say, what is it in this novel, apart from obviously its plotlessness, that I particularly like? There's the way in which the novel ends. What is it about this novel that makes it a special one?
And it, do you, is it specifically to do with the ending of the novel?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no spoilers, everyone. I'm going to read the last paragraph.
I was going to say I think it's a brilliant ending to a novel, but
I do like novels with brilliant endings, but that's not what I'm thinking of.
I suppose what you're getting at is that it's a completely, I mean, it's, let's be honest, it's.
You do me too much credit to think I'm getting at anything. I'm not. There's a specific thing.
Nothing's really tied up.
No, that's, I do like that. Again, I like that. That's not what I'm thinking of. No, the great thing about A Marsh Island is it's one of those novels that ends with its own title.
Yeah.
Ah, of course.
Mrs. Owen was listening eagerly. "Now, Doris," she said, "don't you wish you was there a queen in it?" But Doris and Dan gave each other a happy look that was answer enough. They could not imagine anything better than life was that very day on
their own Marsh
Island.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and to, you know, I always say, wouldn't Middlemarch be a better novel if it ended with somebody saying, "God," and to think it all happened right here in Middlemarch.
Yeah.
Or, and that's why we called him The Great Gatsby. That would be so superior to what Fitzgerald tried.
I adore that. And I adore how knowingly naff it is. I think it's great. She's refused at every point to do the easy thing. We are meant to see this, I think, as an absolute moment of absurdity, of anti-climax. It's brilliant. Hats off. And I mean that as high praise. High praise.
But now it's time for us to leave Dick and Doris and the strange attractions of Marsh Island. Huge thanks to Noreen for giving us the chance to explore the subtleties of Sarah Orne-Jert, and to Tess Davidson for turning our conversation into something fit for the oral archive.
If you would like show notes with clips, links and suggestions for further reading for this show and the 209 that we've already recorded, please visit our website at backlisted.fm. If you want to buy the books discussed on this or any of our other shows, visit our shop at bookshop.org and choose Backlisted as your bookshop.
If you want to hear Backlisted early and ad-free, subscribe to our Patreon, www.patreon.com/backlisted. Your subscription brings other benefits. If you subscribe at the lot listener level for a monthly fee that's less than a brace of Colin Hoover paperbacks, you'll get not one, but two extra exclusive podcasts every month. It features the three of us talking, recommending the books, films and music we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight. For those of you who enjoyed our What Have You Been Reading slot, that's where you'll now find it. It's an hour of tunes, musings and superior book chat. Plus, lot listeners get their names read out like this. Elise Cogan, thank you. Adrian Atterbury, thank you. Mary Hamm, thank you. Penelope Faith, thank you. John McInerney, thank you.
RJ, thank you. Sharon Hennessy, thank you. Matt Fox, thank you. Ben Clay, thank you. Deborah Quick, thank you. How pleasing that we had people called both Quick and Fox in that run through. Thank you, everyone. Now, Noreen, before we go, is there anything you would like to add on the subject of A Marsh Island that we didn't get to in our conversation?
The only thing I'd say is I love, one of the things I love is how often Dale runs out of energy. I find that very relatable. You know, it's like, I would do it. I just got tired.
He doesn't seem to be an artist who's terribly, what's the word? Intense.
No. He gets intense.
He has his kind of moments. You know.
And it's that sadder and a wiser man thing, you know, what he's learned is that he has to really put his nose to the grindstone by the end of the novel and get on with his paintings.
Yes, that's right.
He's wonderfully unintense. And I love those lapses into kind of hunger or fatigue.
There's something slightly Vic and Bob about him falling over as well.
Yes.
And,
you know,
had a fall. And then she obviously has to look after him.
I'm thinking of a tiny subgenre, which would include Huysmans, yes, against nature. I love the scenario where the metropolitan dandy flaneurs their way into a harsh, unforgiving rural landscape. That always appeals to me great, probably, again, for personal reasons. I really enjoy that.
They're all so nice to him, though. That's the thing. They're all so nice. They don't really make him feel bad at all.
There's no baddies in this novel, you know, even Dan Lester, yeah.
Exactly what you're talking about. Like, it takes, it's not like an American Werewolf in London where they go into the slaughtered lamb and everyone turns around in a hostile or all manner of other. It's like he knocks upon a door and they go, "Hello, would you like to come in?"
Yeah, I mean, it's like, this and other extraordinary revelations in the next installment of A Marsh Island. I think it's a brilliant novel.
I think this is a wonderful. I thought it's a wonderful book, and one of the, for me, one of the nicest and most stimulating discoveries we've had on Backlisted for a while. So thank you, Noreen. Wonderful, wonderful choice.
I'm so thrilled you liked it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
We'll be back in a fortnight.